Daisy.
And I'm Terry.
And this is the Monday Mindset Podcast,
where we talk about things of interest to us and hopefully to you.
So let's get started with episode number 31. This week it's Terry's turn to share something with us. What have you got for us this week, Terry?
Well, Daisy, so once again, I chose someone who is a psychologist. This is a podcast that I've never mentioned before, and actually one that I've only started listening to a few months ago, and it's called Well-Being with Rick Hansen and Forrest Hansen. Now, Rick Hansen is a well-known psychologist, has written books, and very prominent in the treatment of anxiety and depression. He's written books called Hardwiring Happiness, Resilient, and Buddha's Brain. And Buddha's Brain is probably the one where some people may recognize him. His son, Forrest, is a business kind of entrepreneur and did training and schooling in marketing, and he's worked with some of the best in the field. So a lot about kind of how we think and how that affects our purchasing habits and different things. So it's very interesting to listen to the two of them. And in their podcast, they talk about theories about change and mental health. But interestingly to me, they also talk a little bit about how to use mental health services and when to be skeptical of things and when to take in things. So I really like this series. Mm. So this episode is episode 114, How to Change Your Brain. You and I have talked about this before, and I'm going to try to really just simplify this, and I really like their podcast for this reason, is they don't get real heavy in the science, but really more into the practical. It's about the concept of neuroplasticity, and that is the changes that take place within our brain. And the fact that we didn't know about this until more recently in our history, so it's really fascinating, but basically, our brain makes actual changes based on information and mental activity, and that the flow of this information actually leaves lasting changes in our neural activity in our brain due to chemical responses and the pathways that get strengthened. And this can be based on external or internal stimuli. So our thoughts can even stimulate changes in our brain. So, of course, you and I have touched on this before, but these two, they focus on it very strongly here.
It's such a fascinating concept, though, isn't it? That your thoughts can actually create these. I mean, I think of it, you mentioned last week about how you find it useful to have an image for something or, you know, an image or an analogy to help you understand something. And I always just think of these, you know, you can literally visualize a pathway, but every time you talk about it, it just blows my mind that, yeah, repeated thoughts can just create these, I think of them as these sort of ruts in the road that are created in your brain. It's, yeah, I find it.
Absolutely.
It's incredible.
And our behavior and our thought can create these. Mm. And so when you think about all of the self-help industry and behavior change talks and books, there's so many of them. And I think where oftentimes we miss out on the benefit of them is we just learn them factually. And that really does nothing to change our brain. And so this talk was really about how we can help change the neural activity in our brain. So even as you mentioned in our last episode, when we were discussing Brené Brown's concepts, her comment about that we are looking for evidence that we don't belong, that is a habit, that is a way of thinking that got started for us and has been reinforced thousands of times. And now it is hardwired into our brain, and that's what we're seeking. And the challenge with this is that we have naturally a negativity bias, and many of us have heard that term before, but I love the way Rick Hansen talks about this. He says, basically, the negativity bias is, it's like the neurons in our brain are Velcro to negative experiences. Hmm. We latch onto those, but they're like Teflon for positive experiences. Hmm. Forrest goes through an example of, you know, you spend a day, you go to work, you do all these things. At the end of the day, what do you think back to? And he talked about the idea that throughout the day, you maybe had 5 or 6 negative things happen. A dog barked at you when you were going to your car, you spilled your coffee, you got an irritating email, and something else. And then positive things happen too. One of your colleagues said, hey, let me take care of that for you, and other positive things happen. But at the end of the day, when you reflect on the day, our negativity bias means you will probably still recall the negative events and not the positive. So again, we are wiring those responses to those type of experiences stronger and stronger, which means that's what we're going to pay more attention to as well. So it just keeps strengthening.
I like that. Negative Velcro, positive Teflon. That's good, that.
Yeah. So again, this is a newer part of science that we've been learning about how the brain actually changes. And it was once thought that the brain only grows and changes up to maybe in our 20s. And there's even more evidence now that that's not true. Into our 60s, 70s, and 80s, we can still be changing with neuroplasticity. One of the things I like about the movement of people like Rick Hansen and others like this is they're not just talking about what I describe as the woo-woo that say, hey, if you meditate, it'll be good for you. They actually use science to show how it impacts people. And so there's a famous study where they actually look at brain activity of monks who have been meditating extensively for a long period of time, and then those who are more new to it and it's a newer experience in their brain. And what they find is there are actual changes in the makeup of the brain and the type of brain waves that are active. And what they find, and this is not a commercial for the benefits of meditation, but it might be that in the end, what they found with the monks who meditate frequently and have done so for a long time, they actually have improvements in their regulation of attention, their body awareness and self-awareness in general, their emotional control, impulse control, and overall more lightheartedness and integration of self. Those are pretty amazing changes to look at in this way. They also talked about learning information and how, again, it changes the brain. And another study where they looked at taxi drivers in London, and they actually saw that because they had to learn all these maps, which of course now we don't do because we have devices that tell us when to turn, but they had to learn so many maps to be able to navigate the area, they actually measured changes in their brain for learning this.
Yeah, I've seen that reference before. They did brain scans and things, didn't they?
Yeah.
And yeah, could actually see those changes because they have to take on a massive amount of information.
So the old notion of you can't teach an old dog new tricks, it just isn't true. Mm. Our brain can grow and change. Mm. And not just it can hold more information, it actually can change structure. And that is so important.
I don't know if they still do that. I presume they do. The knowledge. They go round London, I think, on mopeds or something. I can remember watching a program about them learning it and, you know, just the vast amount of information they have to take on. But the process, you know, they literally drive it as well. So what you were saying before about how thought, but also physically doing things, presumably that just really helps reinforce it, doing the both at the same time, working on both sides of it.
Mm-hmm. And you've heard me reference this, and anyone who's into kind of mindfulness and things will talk about the brain is changed by what it rests upon. And so if we're always resting upon the negative experiences and negative thoughts and feelings, that will be what changes our brain. Mm. We will hardwire it to do that more. Rick Hansen also used this analogy of talking about a garden and the idea that, you know, your garden can have weeds or it can have flowers, and weeds would be the negative experiences and the flowers would be the positive, that we can actually use the flowers to kind of overcrowd the garden so that the weeds can't exist. Unfortunately, for a lot of us, we have it moving in the other direction. We have weeds coming in and crowding out the flowers. and that you can work on pulling the weeds and replacing them with these flowers. So again, you know me that the imagery is helpful for me to picture how this can work.
I tell you what's actually another twist on that, which is really interesting. And I know it's going off on a side note from what you're saying, and it's not what you're saying and what they're saying, but it just put an image in my mind of one of the gardens that I look after. And the borders are, it's that kind of mix of, I guess, a kind of almost like a prairie style planting. It's that mixture I quite often like with my planting schemes, to have the planting that sits quite nicely in the environment it's in. So this particular garden has, you know, a field, a meadow next to it. So there are quite a few of, you know, wildflowers and things. So my scheme is something that doesn't look completely out of place, although it's obviously a cultivated garden. But there's this very beautiful plant that tends to arrive, which is a weed. It's a member of the carrot family, actually. It's a little bit like, it's like cow parsley. Do you know, cow parsley is probably a British common name for, but it's in the umbellifer family. They look like a sort of upside down umbrellas, the whole family, just lovely, airy, white umbrellas of plants, basically. And the wild carrot is particularly pretty, and it tends to be in the meadows around here, and it lands in the gardens, and it had worked its way into this scheme. And I'd selectively pulled some of them out, but I'd left a few in because they looked very beautiful. And it looked lovely. And I'd got the garden ready for people who were turning up. It was actually the children, I think, my client's son and his family. And when I came back the next time, they had pulled out, they'd very helpfully weeded the borders. But they'd pulled out these very beautiful weeds that enhanced the planting scheme. So sort of gone off on a bit of a side note, really, but just that concept, actually, of thinking the way a gardener thinks, that actually a weed is just a plant in the wrong place.
Mm-hmm.
There are weeds, yes, that everyone agrees they might not like the look of, or perhaps they're like stinging nettles and they sting you, but they are just a plant in a place that you don't want them to be, really. Mm-hmm. But weeds in themselves can actually be very beautiful or very practical or have great benefits, whatever it is. But mm-hmm. just another way to look at weeds.
Yeah, absolutely. And so to really then think about, well, how can we use this neuroplasticity idea to help us learn new things, help us make more concrete behavior changes that we're working on changing? And how can we feel better? How can we change our brain to feel better? Rick Hansen, one of his primary pieces that he's talked about over the years is that we need to be more active in our interaction with beneficial experiences. We pay so much attention to negative experiences. Again, this is our bias. We have this kind of hardwired into us. And talk about that we need to be more aware of positive moments, that we need to take them in and be more mindful and pause in those. And so he actually has some tips on how to do that. He has a strategy that he calls HEAL, H-E-A-L. And that is that we have the positive experience. So that's the H. And then that we want to install these into our brain. And so he talks about enriching. So really magnifying it, stopping and being mindful in that moment and magnifying the positivity of what's occurring. So maybe it's I'm looking at that weed, but to really pay attention to how beautiful it is and what a miracle it is that it came in and can grow like that. The next thing is to absorb it, the A in heal. So spending time really taking it in and taking it in an affective way, not just a cognitive way, but to experience the joy, experience the pleasure of the beauty of something, to really absorb it. And then he talks about L being link, that we can actually begin to link positive to negative. So even when something difficult or negative is happening, we can actually become aware of something positive in the moment, that they're not always one or the other. They're not exclusive of each other. then he talks about a 5-minute strategy that he uses. It's not actually one that takes 5 minutes, but it's kind of giving yourself 5 minutes throughout the day to do some very simple things. So a handful of times throughout the day, when you are experiencing something positive, you see something, you feel something, you are aware of something being positive, to actually slow down. This is, again, where we want to enrich and absorb it. We want to give it time and wait. Let it sink in as we sink into the experience. And I've mentioned this before. BJ Fogg talks about this in the book Tiny Habits. James Clear talks about it in Atomic Habits, that the emotional charge we get when we pay attention to the little steps, that's what creates habit change. And so as Rick Hansen is talking about this, really highlighting for ourselves the positive experiences really makes a difference. That's where our brain is going to start wiring new responses. It's going to change the neural pathways. He then talks about having one thing that you are trying to grow in your experience. So being more mindful, maybe being more assertive, whatever it is, something that you're working on. And throughout the day, to focus on times that you did something toward that. So again, that might take a total of 2 minutes throughout the day that you've several times have stopped just to take note of, I answered that question right away. I was more assertive. That felt good. And then the last thing he talks about is to reset to the deep state, to really sit in. He's obviously a big meditator, mindfulness person, but to really go into a deeper state of the positives of an experience. Which brings me to another point that they made throughout this episode. They often talked about the difference between happiness and positivity, confidence, anything. The difference between state or trait. It's a common thing used in the field of psychology, but the idea that a feeling or a behavior as a state means it's an event that's occurring. That does not change the brain if we leave it just as a state. Like right now, I feel really good. But it's more, we want to ingrain it into our brain to become a trait that we are more optimistic, that we are more joyful. And so again, highlighting these things so that they really get installed into our brain to become a trait rather than a state. Go back to the experiment or the brain testing with the monks. They had trait changes based on this meditation practice versus they felt good in the moment, which would be a state. Something they talked about that does complicate this, and he as a therapist and his son was really aware of this as he tends to kind of watch how people use mental health support, is talking about two S's that often interfere with our ability to do these things. And they're really important to work out. You and I have talked about both of them in various ways, but sleep and stress. When our sleep is off, we can't learn new things. Our neural pathways are not working effectively. So sleep definitely disrupts our ability to make these positive experiences become more of traits for us. And also stress. We can't activate certain parts of our brain when they're offline due to stress. And so be very aware that if your sleep is really off, if your stress levels are very high, those two things are interfering with your ability to make new learning, make new habits happen. And so being more compassionate with yourself and knowing this is a hard time to start a new habit, but you know, I'll keep working on it, but know that those kind of almost environmental influences do make it more difficult. Forrest then talked about something in this episode that I thought was really interesting. And he talked about the benefits of changing our concept of self, because you and I have talked before about cognitive dissonance. So if you tell me, oh, Terry, you're really good at this, but I hold a belief that that's not a true thing, that compliment isn't affirming to me. It actually, I negate it even more by returning back to my old belief. And so we talked a bit about changing of self-concept. And he said, you know, sometimes I just think about, is this how I am or how I want to be? And the idea that, are we experiencing life or creating life? Are we just the result of what we experience, or going to that idea of that we actually get to create who we are? And Rick Hansen jumped in and said, yeah, that's interesting, because really, science shows us that only 1/3 of what makes us who we are is actually in our DNA, which means 2/3 of what makes us who we are is completely within our control.
Wow.
And so that idea that we can change how we conceptualize ourselves, we can change habits using these strategies. And then the last piece of the self-concept that Forrest talked about is, he talked about connecting with yourself as a younger person in some way. Maybe it's looking at pictures, hearing stories or something, but really doing that and having love and compassion for the past you, because you've grown and changed since then. You've learned new things. You have new abilities. And using that as, rather than seeing, I've been like this since I was a kid. You know, even when I was 5, I did that. To look back on that 5-year-old with love and compassion, but see that you can still change that part of you, go back to that trait changing that we can do with neuroplasticity. So again, very simplified version of what they're talking about is the goal for all of us to be more aware of positive moments, take time out to really reinforce them, feel the positive emotional responses, take time to really incorporate them by pausing and then highlighting them, so that we are working to rewire our brains for more positive, working a bit against that negativity bias. We want Velcro for positive experiences.
Yeah, I was going to say, need to switch that. Yeah, switch it around the other way.
Yeah. And so recognizing that even though we are kind of wired this way, we have a lot of control over evolving that into something different.
Yeah, I think that's what's so exciting about the whole area and the discussion around neuroplasticity. In as much as you create those ruts, those neural pathways in your brain from reinforcing these, you know, negative beliefs, what I find so hopeful and exciting about it is that you can do the opposite. Just because you've created those ruts, it doesn't mean they're fixed. It doesn't mean you can't cement them over and create more positive ones. Mm-hmm. That's what I like about the whole field is the real, the hope and positivity that seems to go with it. Mm-hmm. It cuts both ways. Mm-hmm. It tells you about how, you know, you've created these negative pathways, but it also gives you a way to change those into positive ones.
Yeah.
That's what I really like about it. Find it really exciting.
You might really like listening to these two. It's kind of fun too. I think the father son dynamic is interesting, but just kind of interesting to listen to different minds in the field of consumer habits, mental health, and just hear them really talk about this is really inspiring, that we're learning so much about what we're capable of creating rather than focusing on our limits. And that's exciting to me as well.
And you can see how things, like going back to our first episode about gratitude journaling. And again, they've studied these things, haven't they? And probably done brain scans for that as well. But, you know, I shared my own experience with that. I've seen that in practice. You know, I went from somebody who was more likely to have that negativity bias, was more likely to look for the negative in something, just from doing a gratitude journal exercise for 30 days. My brain changed the way it saw things. And was more likely to look for, more likely to focus on the positive in things. And would start doing, just as you were describing it, I was thinking about it, about what you were saying, about taking that bit of time, that pause when something positive happens in your day. And you sort of zoom in on that, mm-hmm. and look at that and think about it, pause on it, flesh it out a bit, give it some details, lodge it in your brain. think about it when you're trying to, you know, revise for an exam, how you do that. Different people have different ways. But I, you know, for example, taking notes from writing it down. So doing that, you know, some form of repetition, but also adding detail, making notes of notes, just building that, fleshing it out and focusing on that, focusing on the positive, making it sticky, making it Velcro instead of Teflon. And on the other hand, when something negative happens, instead of sitting with that and ruminating on it, and I must admit, I still have a tendency to do that, not for every negative thing that happens, but especially maybe a negative experience that happens with perhaps an interaction that has bothered me with somebody, especially if it's some you know, somebody meaningful to me, I'm still a bit too likely to keep ruminating on that. And of course, by doing that, keep revisiting it, I tend to have like conversations with that person in my head, for example. Doing that over and over again, well, that's making that sticky and like Velcro, isn't it?
Absolutely.
So I guess you need to find a way of, and I think it's not denying negative experiences, but I guess almost when they happen, almost being mindful in the moment of perhaps being mindful of them, seeing them experience, but letting them flow. Perhaps, I don't know, trying to visualize them flowing past you in a stream rather than when the positive things happen. You're actually right, I'm just going to hold on to that. I'm not going to let that flow past. I'm going to hold on to it and sit with it for a while. Seems like there's always a balance with what you're doing with something that's more of a negative experience and what you're doing with something that's more positive, and just trying to change how you focus on those two things.
Absolutely. And the idea that I listened to another podcast this weekend with a woman who focuses a lot on gratitude, and she is a meditation teacher, a Buddhist meditation teacher, and she just really focuses on the idea that part of human experience is pain. And part of it is the opposite. And we actually do, we will have both, and we need to have both.
Well, you can't appreciate one without the other, can you? I mean, you know, you go back to, well, you go back to one of my very favorite poems, actually, by Keats, Ode on Melancholy. And that's what he talks about. You cannot experience joy without knowing melancholy as well. Because how can you appreciate one without the other?
But you can't stay stuck on the melancholy. And that's unfortunately what many of us do. The episode that I listened to with her was basically, you know, how to be grateful when things suck. And just that idea that that is natural. Even in moments of things being hard and things being painful, there are still positives happening. And if we can allow ourselves not to just get wrapped up in the negative, and as Rick Hansen says, really try and wrap ourselves up more in the positive, not in denial of the negative. But as he talked about in his heal kind of strategy, that we can actually link the positive with negative versus seeing this can only be negative or this can only be positive, but actually that there's an ebb and flow between the two.
Yeah, and actually the most interesting is when there's a mix of the two. You know, I was thinking actually, you know, it's off on a complete tangent, but it's kind of the same thing. A drama series that I've been watching, and this is more and more what I've been seeing with dramas that I've really enjoyed. Actually, what's interesting are when the good guys have flaws and when the bad guys have things that you like about them. And that makes it more interesting.
It also makes it more realistic.
Yes, exactly.
We can connect with things that seem more real to us. And the idea that even in really positive, there is some difficulty, there is some pain, there is some challenge.
And vice versa. So sometimes difficult to find it, but it's definitely there.
So my hope is that moving forward from today, I'm going to keep looking at giving myself time to appreciate positive, pay more attention to the positive, because this has been a difficult past week or so for me, and I can feel myself starting to focus more on what's difficult. And so I know that I need to shift back over to appreciating the beauty, appreciating the positive feelings. And they can be small. They can be that morning hug when your dog leans into you. But to really start letting that back into my awareness. So I'm going to focus on that part of my neuroplasticity plan and make this a good week. I hope everyone else can as well.
And I liked what you were talking about thinking about growth towards something and focusing on something about yourself that you're trying to grow and develop, and focusing on the examples that day that have taken you one step further towards that. I think that's something that I'd like to focus on more. So that's what I'm going to be taking.
Very nice. I hope everyone has a great week, and we will talk to you soon.
Have a great week.